right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and happy holidays. We got a theme-based show today, and a very serious theme at that. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Hinesh Shamsi, the director of the ACLU's National Security Project, about a recent judicial decision to prohibit any talk of torture in the upcoming military tribunal's secret trials of Guantanamo detainees accused of playing a role in the 9/11 attacks. But before that, we're going to be talking about the whole history of the Obama administration in relation to torture and the consistent violation of every international law and every international treaty concerning torture by Obama and his gang. And I am really pleased to welcome to the show our first guest, and that is Marjorie Cohen. Marjorie's a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law and past president of the National Lawyers Guild. Her most recent book is The United States and Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. And Marjorie's blog is marjoriecohen.com. That's C-O-H-N.com, marjoriecohen.com. And we're going to be talking with Marjorie about a very, very important subject, and that is the Obama administration and torture. So, Marjorie, welcome to the show.
My pleasure, Michael.
You know, I can't help but say, you know, when I saw you did a piece that was called No Accountability for Torturers, and I thought, this is the person that I want to have open up this series that we're doing on Give Me Some Truth, the truth about, you know, Obama and what's going on under Obama. And a thing that there's sort of a serious predicament we're in now, and it's something Bob Avakian pointed out, where there's a lot of people, a lot of progressive and liberal people in this country these days. They have a certain peculiar kind of Oedipus complex. It's not so much that they want to sleep with their mother, but they willfully blind themselves. And so much of that has happened over the last 4 years and continues to happen now that it's just, it poses a tremendous threat for all of humanity. And you seem to be hitting on a very important, you are hitting, not seem to be hitting, but you are hitting on a very important element of this. And this is what Obama is doing in relation to torture and in relation to all the things that went on before him, in a way, even his extension of the Bush regime's program on this front in terms of torture, international relations, all this other stuff. So I wanted to talk to you about that. You wrote this article titled No Accountability for Tortures. What's going on here?
Well, during the Bush administration, officials and their legal mercenaries, John Yoo, Jay Bybee, etc., devised a system of torture and abuse which was then carried out on unknown numbers of people, probably thousands of people, in Iraq, in Afghanistan, at Guantanamo, in the CIA black sites, where they were subjected to torture and cruel treatment. And there was an investigation launched by Eric Holder, the Attorney General, actually a career prosecutor. Durham was assigned to look at any possible liability, not on the part of the officials of the Bush administration or their lawyers, but interrogators. And that investigation was circumscribed by the so-called torture memos. So if the interrogators were following the advice in the torture memos, and the torture memos are full of horrible and illegal authorizations, but if they were following the advice in the torture memos, then they would not be investigated. So the investigation was narrowed to interrogators who did things so egregious that they weren't even permitted by the torture memos. And in June of last year, Attorney General Eric Holder announced that his office would investigate only two incidents in which CIA interrogators were involved in interrogations that ended in deaths. Holder said at the time that the Justice Department has determined that an expanded criminal investigation of the remaining matters is not warranted, unquote. Of course, the remaining matters are the probably thousands of people who have been subjected to torture and abuse. And the two incidents were egregious. They involved the deaths of two men, one Ghul Rahman and the other Monadelle Al-Jamadi. Rahman froze to death in 2002. He was stripped and shackled to a cold cement floor in the Salt Pit, the secret Afghan prison called the Salt Pit. Al-Jamadi died after he was suspended from the ceiling by his wrists, which were bound behind his back. And Tony Diaz, an MP who witnessed Al-Jamadi's torture, said that blood gushed from his mouth like a faucet had turned on when he was lowered to the ground. Al-Jamadi's death was classified as a homicide after a military autopsy. So we have these two egregious incidents which were being investigated. And just last week, Eric Holder announced that based upon the record, there is not sufficient evidence to obtain a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. So he is closing the books on any investigation or prosecution of any torture and abuse that happened during the Bush administration.
We're talking with Marjorie Cohen about the Obama administration taking the Bush regime's torture agenda to higher places than ever imagined. Now, Marjorie, tell me this. Okay, this amnesty is happening despite the characterizations by people that are fairly high up in the ranks of people that run the country, fairly high-ranking military officers. It was General Barry McCaffrey and Major General Anthony Tacuba that actually, if you were looking for evidence, these are people that made some pretty damning comments about what the hell was going on in reference to torturing of people held prisoner by the U.S.
Yes, General Barry McCaffrey said, and I'm quoting, "We tortured people unmercifully. We probably murdered dozens of them during the course of that, both the armed forces and the CIA," unquote. And Major General Anthony Tacuba, who oversaw the Abu Ghraib investigation, wrote, quote, "There is no longer any doubt as to whether the Bush administration has committed war crimes. The only question that remains to be answered is whether those who ordered the use of torture will be held to account," unquote. And Eric Holder has answered that question, and that is, no, they will not. Now, by the way, when he says that members of the Bush administration committed war crimes, torture is considered a war crime under the Geneva Conventions. And I want to say that when the United States ratifies a treaty, it becomes part of U.S. law under the Supremacy Clause of the Constitution. The Geneva Conventions mandate that we either prosecute or extradite to another country where they will prosecute those who commit or are complicit in the commission of torture. And another treaty we've ratified, the Convention Against Torture and Other Cruel, Inhuman, or Degrading Treatment or Punishment, mandates that we prosecute or extradite those who commit or are complicit in the commission of torture. So because under the Constitution, it's called the Take Care Clause, it requires that the president shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed, Obama now, in order to fulfill his legal duty under the Constitution, now that his administration has decided they're not going to prosecute these people, under the Torture Convention and the Geneva Conventions, specifically Article 7 of the Convention Against Torture, mandates that we extradite Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld and Rice and the rest of the torture group, John U.J. Bybee, to another country where they will investigate and prosecute them under universal jurisdiction. Now, keep in mind, Michael, that when Eric Holder closed the books on the investigation of these final two incidents, he said the admissible evidence would not be sufficient to obtain and sustain a conviction beyond a reasonable doubt. Let's take him at his word and assume that's true. That doesn't mean that there isn't probable cause, a much lower standard, probable cause to believe that people had violated our laws. And since there's probable cause to believe they engaged in torture and cruel treatment, then under the Convention Against Torture and under the Geneva Conventions, our administration has a duty to extradite, send these people to other countries where they will be prosecuted. What are the chances of that happening? Zero.
Yeah. Let me remind listeners that we're talking today with Marjorie Cohen. Marjorie is a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, past president of the National Lawyers Guild, and her most recent book, which is now available in paperback, is The United States and Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. Now, Marjorie, that gets me right to what I wanted to get to, which was I'm listening to you, and I'm realizing that, look, a lot of progressive people voted for Obama in 2008. Actually, a lot of them were hoping that he would do something about this situation with torture, which is really a very, you know, grievous crime against humanity that had been done sort of openly and flaunting it, and we got the right to do this, and all these things from the renditioning to the open admission of torture, all the stuff that was shown at Abu Ghraib, all of the things, all the various exposures. It was just sort of like, so what, we're doing it, live with it. And then people voted for Obama hoping that something would be done. But in fact, as you're pointing out, nothing has been done. And that in itself, as you're saying, I think, is that refusing to prosecute these torturers is itself a violation of this law.
It is. And Manfred Novak, who is the former United Nations Special Rapporteur on Torture, said that during the Bush administration, he was getting almost daily complaints about torture. He said that when Obama came into power, he was not getting those complaints, but he was concerned about the failure to hold people accountable. And although I do not see any evidence that torture is occurring on Obama's watch, at least in other countries, there is still torture going on in the supermax prisons in this country in the form of solitary confinement and cell extractions. That's covered in one of the chapters in the United States in torture. But solitary confinement, experts say, can lead to hallucinations, catatonia, suicide. But there is no evidence that I've seen that the Obama administration is engaging in torture. But there was one thing that really concerned me and should give other people pause, and that is when General Petraeus was testifying before Congress to be confirmed as the incoming CIA director, he said there might be some incidents where we might have to return to enhanced techniques, enhanced interrogation. That's another word for torture. So although I don't see evidence that that's actually happening, he left that door open, which is worrisome.
Which leads me to two questions, Marjorie. And the first one being, there is a situation in the world right now where one of the ways that they've dealt with sort of the question of renditioning, they dealt with actually even these enhanced interrogations. Well, there's a place, Bagram, that so little is known by that. This is a black site that they continue to maintain. And from what I've heard and with past guests and from what I've read in various sources, Bagram currently holds somewhere over 3,000 people, and they just applied for the permission to increase that number by 5,500. And no one has any idea what's going on inside Bagram.
Well, the Obama administration turned over most of the prisoners at Bagram to the Afghans, I think it was yesterday or the day before. But yes, there have been allegations of torture coming out of Bagram. And the Bush administration denied habeas corpus to prisoners at Guantanamo. Habeas corpus means that a person has a right to go before a neutral judge, a federal judge, and say, I'm innocent, I should be released. And the Bush administration maintained that since Guantanamo was on Cuban soil, not U.S. soil, that these prisoners weren't entitled to habeas corpus. The Supreme Court said, oh no, that's not true. In Boumediene, the Supreme Court said that you cannot keep someone out of court just by locating a prison 90 miles off your shore and saying it's on Cuban soil, because the United States exercises complete jurisdiction and control over Guantanamo. So they settled that issue for Guantanamo, but what about Bagram? And there is an argument that it is part of the battlefield, although once somebody is taken off the battlefield and put in the Bagram prison, and they're no longer on the battlefield. So those prisoners have not been entitled to habeas corpus, and they have been entitled to a very, very reduced level of due process, if at all. So yes, it's very difficult to know what's going on there.
And then the other question is, and again, you've answered this in some ways, this question of all of the various international conventions, and I'm thinking in particular of the U.S. Torture Convention and the War Crimes Act, they're pretty unequivocal around this, that nothing is ever a justification for torture. These international conventions, which nations that sign onto them are obliged to follow, yet the U.S. turn around and they're arguing that there may be justification for this kind of thing when these things all say there's no justification for torture at all.
Right. Well, you had the chief legal mercenary, John Yoo, who is now a professor at Berkeley, teaches constitutional law, by the way, teaches it in an undisclosed location. So that if you want to take John Yoo's course, you're sworn to secrecy. I wonder what he's afraid of.
So that explains.
But he came up with these incredible meaning unbelievable, arguments justifying the torture and abuse. John Yoo, Dick Cheney, and George W. Bush still maintain to this day that waterboarding is not torture, and they're proud that they participated in the decision to waterboard and they would do it again. Waterboarding has long been considered to be torture. The United States prosecuted, convicted, and hung Japanese military leaders after World War II for waterboarding as torture. And by the way, Mitt Romney also maintains that he would engage in waterboarding, you know, authorized waterboarding. He doesn't think it constitutes torture either.
Let me remind listeners that we're talking today with Marjorie Cohn. Marjorie is a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, past president of the National Lawyers Guild, and her most recent book, which is now available in paperback, is The United States in Torture. And we're talking with Marjorie about the Obama administration and torture. Now, Marjorie, one of the things I wanted to ask you about is when you brought up you and actually your explanation of you teaching in an undisclosed site. You know, this is an insane thing we've got going on here. And at the same time, it's such a criminal scene. And when you think about this, one of the things, again, when people thought that Obama would stop the Bush program, that it would entail bringing to justice the people who had put into practice and given the legal justification and all this were part of these heinous crimes against humanity would be brought to justice. And in fact, nothing has happened. But I don't know how much people really understand the significance of him refusing to prosecute you and Bybee.
Right. You know, some people say, well, these are lawyers. They were just giving their clients legal advice. You can't go after them. And in fact, there is precedent for holding lawyers accountable for war crimes and crimes against humanity. And that is United States versus Altstetter, where the United States government, after the Holocaust, actually tried and convicted Nazi lawyers of war crimes and crimes against humanity for advising Hitler on how he could legally, and I put that in quotes, legally disappear people to concentration camps and get away with it. So there is precedent for this. One other thing that I want to say, Michael, is that while the Obama administration is not pursuing accountability for these people, they are going after whistleblowers in a very heavy way. For example, pursuing criminal charges against John Kiriakou, a former CIA officer, on charges that he disclosed the identity of other CIA officers who participated in interrogations. Arresting and holding Bradley Manning on charges that could get him life in prison. Bradley Manning, by the way, was subjected to torture when he was in the first 9 months of his incarceration in a military brig. He was held in solitary confinement, which, as I've said, many people say amounts to torture. He was also subjected to humiliating and degrading treatment, which also violates that treaty, the same treaty, by being paraded naked in front of other inmates. It was only after people, including, I'm proud to say, 250 law professors, wrote a letter to the Obama administration saying this is unacceptable, that Bradley Manning was actually transferred to another prison in Fort Leavenworth, where he is now in the general population. Another example, Julian Assange, who is holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in London because he is afraid that London will extradite him to Sweden just for questioning. They haven't charged him with anything in Sweden. He has agreed to make himself available in the Ecuadorian embassy for questioning. But the Swedes, who you know are getting a lot of pressure from the United States, are saying, no, we want him extradited to Sweden. And then the fear is, and there's good reason for it, that Sweden would then extradite him to the United States where he could face espionage charges. For allegedly publishing on WikiLeaks memos and documents allegedly given to WikiLeaks by Bradley Manning, many of which show evidence of war crimes by the Bush administration. And yet the New York Times didn't do anything different than WikiLeaks in publishing this information, and you don't see the Obama administration going after the New York Times. But they are coming down very hard on whistleblowers, not at all on war criminals.
Let me remind listeners that we're talking today with Marjorie Cohn. Marjorie is a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, past president of the National Lawyers Guild, and her most recent book, which is now available in paperback, is The United States and Torture. And we're talking with Marjorie about the Obama administration and torture. Now, Marjorie, again, it's amazing to think of each time you want to say it's more heinous than before, but it's all just very, very, very disturbing and very enraging. And this is the question of the kill list. Where is the uproar? That's what I want to know. Where is the uproar around this, that this guy actually has a kill list? Extrajudicial killings are perfectly fine, and no one's really out in the streets about it.
No, you're right. Joe Becker and Scott Shane reported a few months ago in the New York Times that Obama has a kill list that after he consults with his counterterrorism advisor, John O. Brennan, then Obama personally makes a decision to have people executed. Brennan, you might recall, was closely identified with torture in secret prisons and extraordinary rendition during the Bush administration. And this Times story, which was based on interviews with 36 current and former Obama advisors, says that basically Obama is avoiding the complications of detaining additional people like in Guantanamo, which he has been unable to close because Congress has used it as a political football. But what he does is he kills them, takes no prisoners, so he doesn't have to worry about where they're being held. And this is really outrageous. I mean, it's illegal, and it also is ineffective. It actually backfires because when people in other countries, Somalia, Pakistan, Yemen, see the U.S. drones dropping bombs on and killing many, many civilians. And the Obama administration defines civilians selectively. In other words, if you're a boy of military age and you're in a certain area, then you're not considered to be a civilian. And so they say, well, the number of civilians killed with these drones has been in single digits, and people just don't believe that. I mean, there have been studies that some 957 deaths in Pakistan in 2010 from the drones. But when these people see civilians being killed by these U.S. drones, it makes them hate us even more, not less. And what just came out, and actually a couple of days ago in The Guardian, was an article by Chris Woods from the Bureau of Investigative Journalism in London talking about a drone strike in Yemen on Sunday in the Yemeni city of Rada'a, where at least 10 civilians were killed, many women and children, and how the Yemeni government has actually taken credit for these drone attacks, and the Musharraf government in Pakistan as well, so that the CIA will not be blamed, which is interesting. First of all, if the Obama administration claims that drone attacks are legal, why are they covering up that they're using them? And secondly, what propelled the governments of Yemen and Pakistan to take credit for these drone attacks when this would really anger their people? There must be tremendous pressure applied on them. But keep in mind that these drone attacks, they're two different kinds. One are called personality strikes, which target suspected militants, right? This is no due process, no arrest, no trial. And then there's another kind, they're called signature strikes, where they don't have names of people so much as suspicious patterns of behavior in certain places controlled by a terrorist group. So if you're in that area, you can be killed by a drone. And the Obama administration says, well, you know, we have the authorization for use of military force that Congress passed just days after 9/11. But Congress rejected the Bush administration's request for open-ended military authority to deter and preempt any future acts of terrorism or aggression. It just authorized force against the groups and countries that supported 9/11. And in fact, in the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012, Congress specifically said nothing in this section will expand the authority of the president or the scope of the authorization of the use of military force. Drone attacks violate international law. They violate the Geneva Conventions. They violate the well-established international law principle of proportionality and distinction. Proportionality means that attacks can't be excessive in relation to anticipated military advantage, and distinction requires that they be directed only at a legitimate military target. Both of these principles are being violated. So some people in the Obama administration say, well, this is self-defense under the UN Charter. Well, the self-defense provision of the UN Charter is a very narrow exception to the Charter's prohibition on the use of force to settle international disputes. In order to use self-defense under the UN Charter, it has to be a response to an armed attack against a UN country, or the necessity of self-defense must be imminent. And drone attacks don't meet that standard. What Obama is doing, although he's not calling it the war on terror, which is what the Bush administration called it, you know, terrorism, by the way, is a tactic. It's not an enemy. You don't declare war on a tactic. And yet, under the guise of the war on terror, Bush shredded the Constitution. Obama doesn't call it the war on terror. He calls it the war on Al-Qaeda. But what he's doing and what his administration is doing is going far beyond, even if we were entitled to go take out whoever we thought was Al-Qaeda anywhere in the world, which we're not. You know, you can't say the whole world is a battlefield. This is going way, way beyond that. And there was an op-ed in the New York Times a couple of months ago by a man named Ibrahim Mothana, and it's called How Drones Help Al-Qaeda. And he says in that op-ed, drone strikes are causing more and more Yemenis to hate America and join radical militants. They are not driven by ideology, but rather by a sense of revenge and despair. So even if they weren't illegal, even if they weren't killing civilians, they're counterproductive. They're actually making us more vulnerable to terrorism, not less.
And we have room for one more question, and it's got to be really quick. Christoph Haines, the current UN Special Rapporteur on extrajudicial summary or arbitrary executions, says targeted killings may constitute war crimes. And I'd like to talk about your view on that in relation to Obama and his response. And at the same time, this point about the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights that made the point that every human being has an inherent right to life that is protected by law and which no one can be arbitrarily denied this right. You know, those two things in terms of war crimes and the responsibility of the Obama regime, what's your thinking on that?
Well, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, another treaty the United States has ratified, not only says no one shall be arbitrarily deprived of his life, but also says that everyone has the right to be presumed innocent till proven guilty, and they're entitled to a fair trial. You can't just take someone out if you think they're acting suspiciously. That violates that particular covenant. And in terms of Christoph Haines, you're right. He actually asked the Obama administration to explain how its drone strikes do not violate international law and specify the basis for decisions to kill rather than capture certain individuals, and whether the country in which the killing takes place has given consent, such as Yemen and Pakistan. And he also wants the procedural safeguards in place to ensure that in advance that these drone killings comply with international law, and wants to know what justice and reparations for the victims and families the Obama administration is coming forth with. And Haines said the United States has not provided a satisfactory response. So here you have Obama saying, you know, I'm the best guy to protect America by these drone strikes. And, you know, there's not a lot of criticism of the drone strikes, because people get much more upset when you see lots of U.S. troops going over to, for example, Iraq and getting killed in the drone strikes. They don't even have pilots in the drones, although there are incidents that some of the pilots, you know, 6,000 miles away, are using joysticks to drive these drones, have suffered post-traumatic stress disorder. But the drone strikes are illegal. They are killing civilians, and they do make us less safe.
All right, Marjorie, thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure, Michael.
And I'm sure we'll have you back again soon to continue up on this whole thing of give me some truth. That's what we need.
Thanks so much.
Sure. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Now. Bye. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Marjorie Cohen, a professor at Thomas Jefferson School of Law, past president of the National Lawyers Guild, and her most recent book, which is now available in paperback, is The United States in Torture, Interrogation, Incarceration, and Abuse. And if you want to follow Marjorie's blog, you can go to www.marjoriecohen.com. All right, we're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with Hina Shamsi from the ACLU, about what the hell is going on at the secret trials in the military tribunals down at Guantanamo. So stay tuned.
I'm sick and tired of hearing things from uptight, short-sighted, narrow-minded hypocrites. All I want is the truth. Just give me some truth. I've had enough of reading things by neurotic, psychotic, pig-headed politicians. Just give me some truth. No short head, yellow belly, son of tricky dicky's gonna mother.
Welcome back. That was John Lennon with Give Me Some Truth. I'm really pleased to welcome to the show my next guest. Her name is Hina Shamsi, and she's the director of the ACLU's National Security Project, dedicated to ensuring that U.S. national security policies and practices are consistent with the Constitution, civil liberties, and human rights. And Hina has been following the hearings and the legal maneuvering that's going on in the upcoming trial of the five people in Guantanamo who are accused of being masterminds and people who plotted out and took part in the attacks on various U.S. targets on September 11th in 2001. Hina, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much for having me.
Okay, well, you know, as we all know, but unfortunately, I think there's a lot that continues to be covered up around this, including the announcement of this most recent development in this upcoming trial, in these pretrial hearings. And the trial, I guess, is they're thinking that it may start sometime in 2013, in the coming year. But there's, you know, as much as I followed it, and I know other people followed it, there's just not doesn't seem to be that kind of like massive coverage of this what's going on from minute to minute so far. And they came across recently, the judge in the military tribunal came across recently with a decision that, one, I mean, just knocked me back in terms of just seeing the character and the nature of it. And I think for people who read it and who have any sense of humanity, would do the same. And that ruling was that evidence of torture is not going to be allowed to be even spoken about in this upcoming military tribunal.
What's the significance of this decision? And if you can explain the decision in more depth, I'd appreciate it. And if you can actually talk about then what you think is the significance of this.
Of course. It could hardly be a more significant decision with respect to the fairness and transparency of the military commissions. And what this decision means, in short, is that the most important terrorism trial of our time will be held not only in a second-tier system of justice down at the military commissions at Guantanamo, but it will also be organized around the judicially approved censorship of the defendant's own thoughts, experiences, and memories of CIA torture. Now, let me take you back to how this began. It began when the government asked the military judge in these trials to approve what it calls a protective order about what information would and would not be made public. And the government argued that any statements by the defendants concerning their exposure to the CIA's detention and torturous interrogation program are classified as sources, methods, and activities of the United States and can be withheld from the public. So when that happened, we at the ACLU filed a motion asking the commission to deny the government's request, and we briefed it, and I went down to Guantanamo in, it was October, to argue that motion. And one of the things that is really, that your listeners may not know, is that the courtroom in which these trials are held is different from any other American courtroom. It is, in essence, a censorship chamber constructed at the cost of $12 million that allows a government official sitting in the corner to press a censorship button and cut off the audio feed to human rights observers and the public who are watching these proceedings to prevent the public from hearing the defendant's testimony about what happened to them. And our concern was that the government should not be able to tell only its one side of the story, that it had a plan to ensure that the American public would never hear the defendants' accounts of the torture, rendition, and black site detention to which the CIA subjected them, and we wanted to stop that on First Amendment grounds. Unfortunately, the judge ruled against us. This is a decision that we plan to challenge.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Hina Shamsi, the director of the ACLU's National Security Project. Well, let me ask you this, Hina. You've mentioned, speaking directly to this 40-second delay, you've mentioned in places where, that I've read, you've said that the problem isn't even so much the actual existence of the delay, and I understand that also I read something where they pump white noise into whatever places are being, where people are listening to this, so it just, clouds it over in that way, which is kind of really bizarre and sort of very 1984-ish kind of thing, Orwell would be extremely proud. But,
right,
there's a point here of you say that the problem, the real problem in all this is the basis for having this delay. Let's talk about that a little.
Of course. So just, again, the mechanics of this. Again, in the courtroom, if there is going to be mention of torture in the CIA program, or there has been mention, then a security official presses the button, and the way that censorship happened is that the audio feed has been delayed by 40 seconds to observers. And our problem is, as you said before, not so much with the 40-second delay, it's the basis for the delay, what is actually going to be censored. And for the first time, a military judge, a judge of the United States, has said that the government has the right to censor people who are not government employees or agents who possess national security information, and it can do so based on their own thoughts, memories, and experiences of their own of government misconduct. And it's hard to imagine something that would be more chilling or Orwellian. And some of the problem here goes back to the government's arguments that we think violate the First Amendment and the judge having gone along with those arguments. The First Amendment has historically protected the public's right of access to commission proceedings. If a court seeks to put something in the way of the public's right of access, then it must find that the First Amendment's very strict standard is met, and that standard is that the government must have a compelling interest that overcomes the strong First Amendment right of the public. And what we argue to the court is that the government has no legitimate interest, let alone a compelling one, in censoring the defendant's accounts of the CIA's rendition, detention, and torture program, because the information is largely out there in the public sphere. It's been disclosed in the government's own documents through government-sanctioned disclosures by the defendants to the International Committee for the Red Cross and through widely disseminated investigative reporting by media and human rights organizations that contain copious details. So, for example, we know in excruciating and minute detail how the torture techniques were applied. We know from the government's own disclosures that that interrogators went beyond even what the Bush administration authorized, that the CIA waterboarded Khalid Sheikh Mohammed 183 times, that it used against its captives beatings, forced nudity, threats against family members, so-called stress positions, deprivation of food, light, and imposition of extreme temperatures. We know the impact of these abuses on the defendants. And the president himself, President Obama, has said that he himself has determined that there would be no harm when he disclosed, he ordered the disclosure of the Bush administration torture memos back in 2009. He said that the interrogation techniques had already been widely reported. The administration publicly acknowledged that portions of the CIA program in public, and that the president had ended the techniques described in the torture memos and authorized by the Bush administration. So the government, in short, has no legitimate basis to keep secret details about torture and abuse that will not happen again. That argument the judge did not even address. His order is remarkable for the fact that it does not even mention the First Amendment.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we're talking today with Hina Shamsi, the director of the ACLU's National Security Project, and we're talking about the sweeping ruling in the military tribunals of the prisoners in Guantanamo that are accused of taking part in the 9/11 attacks in the U.S., and the ruling that basically says that they cannot even mention, and actually, Hina, in one thing, it's like they can't even mention, they can't even think it in terms of revealing what can be revealed about the treatment they've received in captivity, including those first years for people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who was, as you point out, was waterboarded 183 times, was in how many black sites and the rest of this stuff. And at the same time, it was really chilling too when you're talking about all this. I'm thinking, wow, this is, as you're saying, very chilling, including the fact that in one place they say that without limitation, observations and experience of an accused will be treated as classified information as they emerge from a defendant's mouth. And part of this thing of this 40-second delay is they say that even if it seems that they might be going to say something, it's like we can read their minds and we think they're going to say something, then it's blocked out.
That's right. And let's just be very clear about what's happening here. The defendants can talk about it in court, but the judge's ruling and the 40-second delay means that the American public can't hear it. And it also means that any transcript of the trial will have that information redacted if this judge's order is upheld. Now, that is a truly astounding proposition, that the government can subject people to conduct torture that the entire world recognizes as illegal and then prevent the public from hearing about it in American court of law. It is, there's no other word for it. It's a travesty. It undermines our reputation for upholding the rule of law, and it permits the CIA, in essence, to continue to protect itself from accountability at the expense of the public's right to open trials.
You know, one of the things that they use as an argument to justify all this is they say that they already have a rule that no information tainted by torture will be allowed to be used. You know, and they say, that, you know, look, we got a ruling last year or something that said we're not going to be able to introduce evidence that was gotten through the process of torturing people. And that should make everybody's mind, you know, rest easy. And actually, from what I've been reading, there's a number of loopholes there in terms of what they're saying about what won't be admitted and what will be admitted, right?
There are some loopholes. So the Military Commissions Act contains substantive rules and procedures that are different from the ones that we are used to seeing in federal court. And very simply put, it has less procedural protections afforded to the defendants. The Act puts a thumb on the scale on the side of the government. And here, although the Commission's prosecutors and the Act itself would prohibit evidence obtained through torture from being used against the defendants themselves, the reality is that because of loopholes, information obtained from others as a result of torture might be able to come in. And problematically here, the defendants would be prevented from talking about how the torture, for example, impacted them, how it impacted statements that they might have made, how it impacted their entire approach to this trial, and whether or not, for example, some of them are able to even go through this trial. The torture information that has come up and that has been attemptedly censored in the past has been when the defendants are talking about, for example, how the torture that they were subjected to impacts their ability to participate in the trial. If this goes forward, the public could be prevented from hearing mm-hmm. about any of that.
Mm-hmm. And isn't there also a point of, there's also a point of with this whole thing around secrecy, it makes it actually almost impossible for anybody to really be able to discern what in fact is a product of torture and what isn't.
I think it makes it a lot harder. But, you know, the basic point is that this kind of self-serving, self-protective secrecy on the CIA's part has no place in an American courtroom. It doesn't meet the First Amendment standards, and it really does undermine the legitimacy of the military commissions themselves. So to the extent that the government has an interest in claiming that the military commissions are legitimate and fair, the government's approach to censorship of torture, the judge's decision to permit the censorship of torture, entirely undermines it.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Hina Shamsi, the director of the ACLU's National Security Project, and we're speaking about rulings, the most recent ruling in the upcoming trial of the military tribunal of the prisoners from Guantanamo who have been accused of being masterminds and taking part in the 9/11 attacks in 2001. Now, Hina, one thing here is that, you know, we were talking about mentioning this a little bit earlier before the interview, talking about here's the situation where you have this massive clampdown on revealing torture and the inability of people, the defendants, to actually, you know, even fight to prove their innocence or to prove that there's some question or there's some kind of, you know, the beyond the shadow of a doubt would apply to them and be able to prove that. There's a whole question here of, They're doing all this, the government, the CIA, all these people are doing all this stuff about, well, we have to keep this secret because it would damage national security. Yet in the last few months, you have books being written by people who actually carried out torture and were defending the process. And then you have this new movie, Zero Dark Thirty, which is just a repugnant defense of the use of torture against people who are, you know, just picked up and arrested. And how do you get information? Well, you waterboard them a lot, or you beat the hell out of them, or you chain them up in terrible conditions and you humiliate them. This is, you know, and this is being celebrated as the picture of the year. What a glowing piece of art. What a remarkable accomplishment for the American arts and political scene. This is just amazing. What do you think about that?
Well, I watched Zero Dark Thirty last week, and I had a couple of very strong reactions to it. One, that, you know, none of us should contest that the filmmakers have a perfect right to make the film that they want to make. But I think there's a question here about responsibility, because the film starts out, and I'm not going to, you know, give any spoilers here, But the film starts out with a harrowing, heart-wrenching black screen, and you can hear the audio of the victims of 9/11, and we are taken back to the terrible tragedy that occurred that day. And then the next frame says that the film is based on first-hand accounts of actual events. And that is really the first problem with the movie, that it claims to be based on fact, and it expressly, and perhaps not so expressly, links the use of torture to the United States finding and killing of bin Laden. And that is quite simply wrong. This movie is entertainment. It's not fact, but it claims to come across as fact. And that has led three senators in the last week, Senators Feinstein, John McCain, and Senator Levin, to issue a statement saying that the film is grossly inaccurate and misleading when it credits CIA officers with torturing detainees, leading to providing critical information on that leads to bin Laden being found. And part of the problem here is that the film, you know, shows war crimes being committed almost entirely from the perspective of the CIA agents who committed them. So what we don't get is the accounts of all of the other people within the government, including CIA agents, who faced with the same pressures to get information, prevent terrorist attacks, said, we're not going to use torture to do that because it is wrong, it is illegal, and it is ineffective. And with this one-sided tale, the danger is that the public debate will go in a direction that says torture is effective. And in some sense, the question never is whether torture is effective or not. It's wrong. But it sort of entrenches this idea that what we did post 9/11 was excusable. And that's a bigger problem because of, and here I fault the Obama administration, not the filmmakers. The Obama administration provided access to the CIA and the military to the filmmakers for a film that humanizes tortures. Yet in other contexts, the administration is making every effort to suppress facts about the torture program. It's doing that in the context of Guantanamo that we just talked about by building this mechanism in the censorship chamber that allows a government official to switch off the audio feed whenever prisoners talk about their torture in CIA custody. And it is doing so by refusing to release crucial documents from the Bush administration in response to Freedom of Information Act lawsuits filed by the ACLU and others that show, for example, when and how the CIA black sites were authorized, that show internal investigations being carried out against the CIA program that depict or show the hundreds of cables that the CIA sent from the field back up to top decision makers in Washington receiving authorization for that program. So there is a fundamental corruption of our classification system, which means that the information that Americans have about national security policy is information that the government wants them to have. And that information is presented to us in the ways that the government wants it to be presented. That's not a fault of the filmmakers in Zero Dark 30. It is a problem with the government's approach.
Mm-hmm. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Hina Shamsi, the director of the ACLU's National Security Project, and we're speaking about the most recent ruling in the upcoming trial of the military tribunal of the prisoners from Guantanamo who have been accused of being masterminds and taking part in the 9/11 attacks in 2001. Well, let me move on to another subject which I think is related to this, and that is, you know, when you think about the impact of this, I know there's a big debate, and there has been for a couple of years now, around whether or not broad constitutional rights will apply or should apply to the people that are imprisoned in Guantanamo, to these detainees in Guantanamo. Should they actually have coverage by should the rights of the Constitution be extended to these detainees? This is a huge subject, and I think it has everything to do with what then they then decide that the government then decides is perfectly okay to do to people, the silencing of people, the suppression of evidence, the, you know, even the fact that, the, you know, in a certain sense, the way, in a very real sense, the way that people are treated and have been treated in Guantanamo, the actual torture that exists there in terms of the solitary confinement. If you think of, I can't remember the man's name, but he's the last British guy that's in Guantanamo. And he very movingly described, you know, the fact what it was like to be living in solitary in Guantanamo to this day, you know, and it's an incredible, incredible, you know, question. It's a moral question that's facing everyone in the world right now, is how far will you let this stuff go? And do you, you know, I'd like to hear your thoughts on that in terms of this, do broad constitutional rights apply to detainees? And then the idea of, do you think that this is setting a dangerous precedent overall?
Sure. Well, I think the fundamental problem has been for the last 11 years, the Bush administration's claim and the Obama administration's failure to back away from this claim, that we are in a potentially worldwide war in which the regular rules, either of war or of peace, don't apply. And what that has meant is an approach by both administrations to restricting the rights of people based largely on the government's own say-so. And let's bring that down more concretely here. In the cases that have gone to the Supreme Court about Guantanamo, the Supreme Court has reined in the worst excesses of the executive branch by saying that the right of habeas corpus applies, that prisoners there have a right to fair trials, but the government continues to fight the meaning and import of those decisions by continuing to insist that detainees at Guantanamo don't have constitutional rights, and even arguing that the American public's constitutional rights to see the trials or to hear about the trials at Guantanamo are restricted. And nothing could be further from the truth. The problem is that the government's extreme position only means that litigation is going to continue over a course of years, not just months, years, preventing the detainees from having expeditious fair trials, and as well preventing the public from seeing those trials happen. But one thing that's also very important is it's not just the Constitution that applies, it's international law, treaties that the United States has signed and has agreed that it will be bound to. The Geneva Conventions prevent the government from doing what it did at Guantanamo, Bagram, and elsewhere, and human rights treaties require that we provide redress and acknowledgement to people who have been tortured. And one other thing to remember here is that the government's narrative about Guantanamo from the beginning was that it housed the worst of the worst who couldn't be afforded the rights that would otherwise be due to American citizens, until, of course, we come to find out during the Bush administration itself that the vast majority of prisoners at Guantanamo were not the worst of the worst. Many of them were entirely innocent, picked up in the wrong place, wrong time. And as the courts began to get involved for a major period of the last 10 years, that's been lessened now, but for a major period of the last 10 years, the Bush administration, then the Obama administration, released detainees when evidence was put to the test. And it turned out that either the evidence was non-existent or insufficient or skewed and didn't support the arguments the government had made about the people being held at Guantanamo. And what it boils down to is this. Right now, there are more than 80 people at Guantanamo out of a population of 166 who have been cleared for release by our military and intelligence agencies unanimously. Yet, congressional restrictions prevent them from being released. Congressional restrictions are preventing the transfer of detainees against whom there is evidence of wrongdoing to federal courts for prosecution in a system that while it is not perfect, certainly has stood the test of time far better than the military commissions can or ever will.
You know, one final question, again, on this question of dangerous precedent. Does that ring a lot of bells for you in terms of dangerous precedents being set?
I think we are setting and have set a very, very dangerous precedent by claiming that when the government asserts the authority to grant people lesser rights on its say-so in the context of a potentially forever war without geographic limitations, we're establishing a dangerous precedent not only here in the United States and for our approach to the issues presented by terrorism. We're establishing that precedent for other countries. We're doing it in the context of indefinite detention at Guantanamo. We're doing it in the context of targeted killings carried out far from any battlefield. And just imagine what our response would be and should be if Russia, China, Iran claimed the authorities that the United States is claiming right now. We would be objecting and should be objecting because those claims are a threat to the entire system of human rights and law that protects individuals from government overreach. But we are lessening our ability to do that with respect to other countries when we violate those laws ourselves.
Which brings us back to the repugnant, ever more repugnant Zero Dark 30 and the whole way that it turns the world upside down. The idea that U.S. imperialism can do whatever it wants and it's the good guy, but every other person in there, every Arab person, every Afghan person, every Pakistani person, everyone who's opposed to the U.S. is a ruthless killer with no morals and no sense of any respect for anything. And on that note, Hina, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
All right. You know, every time I do a segment like the segments I had on the show today, I start to think about all these people that are out there always saying to me, you know, it's really bad, but it's not what America is really about. It's not what democracy is really about. Oh, yes, it is. Check this quote out from Bob Avakian in the book Basics. In a world marked by profound class divisions and social inequality, to talk about democracy without talking about the class nature of that democracy and which class it serves is meaningless and worse. So long as society is divided into classes, there can be no democracy for all. One class or another will rule, and it will uphold and promote that kind of democracy which serves its interests and goals. The question is, which class will rule, and whether its rule and its system of democracy will serve the continuation or the eventual abolition of class divisions and the corresponding relations of exploitation, oppression, and inequality. I want to thank my guests today, and I want to thank my engineer, Teddy Robinson, and my assistant producer, Henry Carson. I'm Michael Slate, the host and producer of the show, and if you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with a song that's always had a special place in my heart, and I think it's one that has a special place, given what we've been talking about in today's show, and that is None of Us Are Free by Solomon Burke.
Well, you better listen, my sisters and brothers, because if you do, you can hear their voices still calling across the years. And they're all crying across the ocean, and they're crying across the land, and they will too, we all. None of us are free. None of us are free.